Clinic session number 31509, Reel 5.
I had some excellent pilots. One of them, Rahim Khan, eventually finished up as the senior most Pakistan Air Force officer. And after that, he became an ambassador in various countries for Pakistan. Another was a man called Chopra, who finished up as the top air pilot after the war for Air India. And the others went to Scotland and so forth, as they did. I like to think that something of what I gave to Rahim was what he picked up from me. Little tricks and things of that sort. He was a quick learner, and his style of flying, of course, was modeled on mine, which was pretty adventurous. And I taught them how, without using the controls of his aircraft, was trimmed to flying straight and level. And in these light aircraft, you put your hand out as though you were going to turn to the left. The wind on that would turn the aircraft to the left and the right. And I said, if you dip your arm down like this, using an aileron, the air flowing out of it will drop the nose. And you can do the same. And little silly things like that. But anyway, it made them feel much more that an aeroplane was not an alien thing, but was a part of themselves, which I thought was important. I never heard of anybody else doing it, but they probably did. well, the year came and went, and I thought about, well, what about that promise of another board and being posted to a squadron at last? And at the end of 3 months, nothing had happened, and I had several times mentioned this and was getting slightly miffed that I told them, well, we can't spare you now. And I had written to the Air Ministry saying that I had seconded to the Air Force from the Army in answer to the SOS in 1941, that I had gone through my training course, and that I had not gone to a squadron because of the sickness, but that I was now fit to do so, and I was not being allowed to do so. And I considered this as a breach of face and a promise that we had all been made. Well, nothing happened, and 3 months went by, and I was getting more and more fed up. I didn't like the new CO. I didn't like the wing commander flying. I didn't like the group people who had come down who never flew. And one day I took the airplane out myself, a light Tiger Moth, and I beat the airfield up. And I beat up flying control. I beat up the hangars, and to them sitting on the ground, they thought, idiot, what's he doing? He's going to kill himself. Well, I knew damn well, I knew what my limitations were, and the aircraft limitations. I had over 1,000 hours on this airplane. There was no question why not feeling part of it. Anyway, I put on what they called when I came down to ground, a disgraceful show in front of all those young pupils. And I was grounded, of course. And they said, we're going to see that you're sent back to the Army. Well, I thought that was very unfair. And I was looking around as to whether I could get into the Army branch of flying where you flew air operational AOP squadrons. There were several, 656 was one of them. We did ground spotting for guns and things of that sort. And you pulled casualties out from forward places where they couldn't be. You could fly them out, but you couldn't get them out in an ambulance. But before I got very far in that, a signal came from Air Ministry in London saying, Douglas, to report to the Middle East for operational squadron training immediately. Well, the relief I felt and the pleasure I felt when that signal came was unbelievable. And I was very worried before that, because I'm never going to see anything in this war of fighting. And it wasn't that I was bloodthirsty, but I felt that it was my duty. And I, sitting back in a comfortable flying school, doing nothing except teach people to fly, fine, but not enough for me. Well, I was posted to the Middle East. Arrived in Cairo, had to spend 2 or 3 weeks there. It was too late to join the course that had started about a couple of weeks beforehand, and join the next course. When I was in Cairo, I had some marvelous experiences, including one with King Farouk, but that's another story.
Well, that would be interesting to hear something about King Farouk, I think.
Well,
given the history.
I'll start with how it all happened. When we embarked on a ship, we didn't fly to Cairo. We embarked on a ship, the Ranchi, which was a P&O ship that had been doing war service now, at Bombay, and we, full ship, taking replacements for the Middle East and for Greece from India. And there were nurses on board, of course, and there was an ENSA team, beautiful girls who had been going around the jungles and stations in India entertaining the troops. And one of them, I kind of fell for, hook, line, and sinker. And on a crowded troop trip, there isn't much you can do except chat and play lardice in the bar and things of that sort. But I said, I'm going to the Middle East and I'll be in Cairo. And she said, well, we're going to be in Cairo for a time. We're putting on several shows there. And when we got to Suez, where we all got off the ship and went by land up to Cairo, I was dropped off at a place called Shalufa, where I went into a transit camp because there was nowhere for me, no space for me ready in Cairo at that time. But 10 days later, I did go up to Cairo, but in that 10 days down at Shalufa, it was utter boredom. The food was terrible. I ate bread and marmalade every day and drank tea. That was my diet. But for fun, I used to go down to the canal, which was not very far away. We had to take a minute to airport transfer. I swam the canal several times across. Now, I always found that there is a tide, not a tide, a current flowing through the canal. The water is very, very salt, much salter than the sea, probably due to the evaporation of the salt water as it did its 110-mile journey through the hot desert sands, which fortunately kept sharks and things like that away. And of course, there was always the movement of ships up and down. And the current flew, the ships never traveled each way down the canal. For 4 hours or 6 hours, for example, there'd be all ships would go through northbound and vice versa, southbound. And as they moved with their big hulls, they moved the water, and that set up the current which went through the canal. So when you dived into the canal to swim across, you finished up several hundred yards further down or further up, and you had to remember that and walk up to where roughly the opposite way we go, and then you'd find yourself still away from it instead of double the distance. It was delightful in the desert to be able to go into the canal. Although the water was warmer than the sea, it was still very refreshing. But that's all I did for 10 days until I got to Cairo, where I was posted into what was called in the old days and had been taken over by the RAF, the Heliopolis Palace Hotel, full of RAF pilots, all going different ways. And I'll say they were in Cairo, which is where we were accommodated. The amusing thing I had found there when I was staying in the Heliopolis Palace Hotel was watching all the Italian servants that we had. They had been taken prisoner in North Africa, and they were now being our batmen, quite happily. They were glad the war was over for them, and they would sing, as the Italians always do, with pleasure, O Sole Mio, and all these other tunes. And they would go down to the railings in the afternoon. They were not allowed outside, but they were on their honor not to do so, where they would ogle the Egyptian and other girls that went by. And it was a strange situation. They were very unbellicose, and they were acting as our valets and waiters. Well, I may be exaggerating a little bit there, but that's who provided the services in the hotel. Of course, I wasn't on any course. I had to wait 3 weeks and nothing to do. And the first thing I did, of course, was I'd got the address, the answer address for their girls, and I called this girl. I don't know if you want the name, it's not important. I, in a sense, would prefer not to mention it. She's an extremely nice person. And we were out all the time together. Cairo, even in wartime, was a city of fleshpots. Marvelous restaurants, and marvelous nightclubs. And as far as one could afford it, one was bored. One lived the life of Riley, going out every night, eating places. Some of the restaurants were open air, and you could watch a film whilst eating your supper, and you could dance afterwards in a courtyard with vineyards around it and fairy lights. I mean, there was no blackout.
One hears of Shepherd's Hotel.
Shepherd's
Hotel.
That
marvellous?
Absolutely fantastic. Spent a lot of time in Shepherd's Hotel. Met several of my brother officers and senior officers I knew in Shepherd's, and whom I hadn't seen since I was in the cavalry regiments. And we had terrific meetings. There were no beat ups or that thing, but plenty of pims and to drink and venture to talk about, and quite a social life.
Would this have been about 1943, do you think?
This would be late. This was in 1943. Oh, I beg your pardon. This was in 1944. The summer of 1944.
So, as you say, with the Italian prisoners, the war was well and truly
the
over.
The war was over. They couldn't go home yet, of course, because of the war.
And I suppose the Italian campaign was ongoing.
It had just started, Sicily, and it was before Cassino and things like that, just before. But as whilst the British forces were gradually going up north, and they were held up.
You were there at a good time, Gavin.
Yes, I was. Yes, I was extremely lucky in that sense. However, I took Joan to one of these nightclubs one evening, and the Auberge de Pyramid. This was an open air nightclub near the Great Pyramids at Giza. And I had met a friend of mine, young Indian Maharaja called the Maharaja Sirmore. And I invited him to come and have dinner with me at the Auberge de Pyramid. And I invited Joan to come along with me. And whilst we got there quite early for Cairo, about 9 o'clock at night, the place was virtually empty. I got a very nice table from the head waiter. I had the Maharaja to the mall with me. I don't want it too near the band where it'd be noisy. I want it to be near the floor, where we can see everything well, and we'd like to have a nice dinner. And he gave us a very good table, and the Maharaja Sirmo, who had a nickname, an English nickname, he was always known as Reggie of Sirmo, and was introduced to Joan, and I could immediately see that his eyes shone when he saw her, because she was a very beautiful girl. And we were sitting down chatting, and we'd ordered dinner, a very good menu. I mean, incredible to think it was 1944, the Great War. Everything was there as you wanted, and plenty of drink. And we'd been waiting for everything had to be cooked, so we'd probably been chatting for at least a half an hour, waiting to be served. When party of well-dressed Egyptians with red fezzes on their heads young, educated, looking chaps, a bit sinister looking, came and sat down at the next table to ours. And in a minute or two after they had all settled down, who came in but King Farouk with one of his attendants, and he sat down with them. And there was a table of about 8 Egyptians, I suppose, altogether, 7 or 8 Egyptians, in the neighboring table, and they ordered them. Well, I learnt afterwards that the Obeid Pyramid was one of his favorite haunts. He visited probably 5 nights out of 7 every week, from where he had gone to somewhere else. Or he'd go somewhere else first and then come on there. And after we'd been sitting quietly, still waiting for our food, because the waiters and all that were all around the royal party, looking after them and taking orders. And they didn't order meals, but they ordered drinks and things, that's all. And one of them came over. We hadn't noticed it until he came over and clicked his heels in front of Reggie and said that the king would very much like to meet him. So Reggie, Joan and I were talking, and said, "Oh, what, Reggie?" And he told us what. "I've been to the next table. I'll be back in a few minutes." So he went over, and Joan and I were talking still, and the same chap came over and clicked his heels in front of Joan and said, "The king requests your presence at the table." So he went over. "Sorry, Gavin, I have to go out here, royal command." I said, "It's all right." And I was sitting there for about 10 minutes. And I thought, "God, I've ordered 3 dinners. I can't eat these dinners all by myself. And they haven't invited me over. What should I do? Should I discreetly disappear and leave no money for the meals that I wasn't having? Or can I do that anyway? It's going to be tricky." And I was thinking, well, what should I do? When the same chap came over and clicked his heels and asked me to join them. But I'd been sweating for a time, wondering what I should do. We hadn't sat for long and had a round of drinks when we were told that we were going to be taken to the king's private nightclub. It was called the language in Egypt amongst the top classes was French, of course. His private nightclub is called the L'Auberge de I'll think of it in a minute.
Yeah. Not to worry, it was his private nightclub. That's the important
thing. It was his private
nightclub. Yes.
And we got it. We went outside, and we. Sorry, still. Seen a moment. We went outside, and there were 3 or 4 black limousines outside. And some of the staff got into the first car, 3 of them, and I think I was one of them. The rest piled into the second car, and the third car. The fourth car was the king's, and the fifth car was a backup car, which came behind. But they were all similar cars. They weren't flying any flags or special Scotland number plates, of course, indicated that they were royal cars. And we drove off quite a distance from the pyramids, back into central Cairo and over to the west somewhere, where we arrived at a very high granite-looking wall with a little green door in it. It reminded me of the green door in Alice in Wonderland. And there was a little peephole, and one of the members of the king's staff got out and knocked on the door, and an eye appeared in his little hole, and immediately the door was open, and we all filed in. And there was this exquisite open-air nightclub with a marble floor to dance on, with shrubs and flowers all around it, a few chairs, many places surrounding it with shrubs and flowers, mostly roses, with benches on which you could sit. And of course there was a raised dais with a platform for the musicians, Well, when we walked in, the whole lot was there, and they were, the pianist was lying on the keys of the piano with his head on his hands, and the others were draped over their violins, whatever the instruments they played. And they had to be there every night until 4 o'clock in the morning in case the king turned up. And the place was empty, we thought. And we sat down, and within a minute, the floor was full of dancing couples, young Egyptian women and their husbands, who were part of the staff of the various palaces. And they also, like the musicians, had to be there every night in case the king turned up, and have shows and dance and have the music going the moment when he...
So they had to be there every night.
They had to be there every night. We learned all this, of course, of conversation. She'd hung up. And, I forgot to mention that with Joan we had another of the Ensor girls. So there was one for Reggie. And one for me, for two, so we were equally balanced. And these two girls had been invited to go with the king in his car. So they came in the fourth car. I think I'd better refrain from explaining or mentioning what they told me that he tried on in the car when he was alone with them. he had a great reputation for chasing after women, but he was very impotent, and he'd try everything, but nothing much happened. But he did love women, and he was. Any women. He was younger than I was, funny enough, but he looked 40 years older. By this time, he was 40. He was fat and 50 in appearance. He'd been to. I think he went to Harrow when he was a young boy. Very good looking, almost effeminate looking, rather sort of soft looking, but. A rather pretty boy when he, from photographs I saw him. When I first saw pictures of him, when I met him, he had a goatee beard and a heavy moustache and was very fat.
Did he speak to you?
Yes. He spoke to all of us, but his attention was on the girls the whole time. He used to go to these nightclubs to pick up girls. You see, part of it. And
what did they think of it? Did they tell you how he'd carried on in the car?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he went straight to the point. The back of this enormous black saloon was huge. I mean, there was room for people to sit facing each other and all that sort of thing. But he sat in the middle and went on either side of him. His hands were all over them, and up the dresses and down the fronts and all that sort of thing. He was gentle. He wasn't brutal or also. And they'd had a fair amount to drink, and it wasn't their first experience of being mauled around a little bit, you know. So they took it all in good spirit. They didn't want to offend him. And they thought, well, this drive can't go on forever. So I think they put up with it. They told me all about it. Afterwards, of course, we had a good laugh and told it Reggie as well. Well, we danced. Well, I should say that one of the first things that happened when we arrived at this private nightclub, Le Club de Pêche et de Chasse, the Club of Fishing and Hunting, Le Club de Pêche et de Chasse, we were given little scarlet cardboard cards with gilt edges, making us life members. It didn't mean anything. He didn't stay on as a monarch for very many years after that, as you know. But it was a souvenir which I kept for many years. Unfortunately, I seem to have lost somewhere in my very many moves. But all four of us were given little scarlet membership cards, the sort of about the size of the present-day credit card. Very pretty they were. Well, we danced on the floor there, and eventually the king decided, because by this time it was pretty late, it was around four-ish, he got there at about 2:30, he decided he had enough, and he'd had enough to drink too, and he was escorted and went off, leaving us with the transport to take us back to wherever we wanted. And we were given a card, I think two cards, but we only took one of them. The four of us got into one of these huge limos and took us back into our part of Cairo. Us two, she was living in, I think, Harry, another Claridge's, which was taken over by Ensor. I went back to the Heliopolis Palace Hotel. And Reggie went off to Shepherd's or wherever he was living. And that was my sole encounter with King Farouk. It had been amusing and a very unusual evening.
Indeed, yes. Well, thank you very much for telling us about that, Gavin. Yes. And this is the end of Reel 4 and Reel 5. Thank you.